Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Before we begin here today, change is coming. ID the Future is transitioning to a new podcasting platform. Now, this is behind the scenes, so if you subscribe to ID the Future through Apple, Google, or Spotify, your subscription should transfer automatically. If, however, for any reason you don't see subsequent episodes appearing in your podcast player on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, head on over to idthefuture.com to get reconnected. That's idthefuture.com.
Welcome to ID the Future. I'm your host today, Mike Keyes. Today, we're going to continue our conversation with Dr. Richard Weikert on the topic of scientific racism. He's written a number of books about it, including books specifically about Hitler's role in this, as he inherited some ideas through a complicated chain that began in many ways with Darwin. And so he's published a book, for example, Hitler's Religion and Hitler's Ethic, that deal with some of the Darwinian ideas that made their way to Hitler. So, Dr. Weikert, thanks for joining us again today.
Yeah, it's great to be with you.
All right. So in our last podcast, we were talking about scientific racism, its earlier history. We got up to the point of Darwin, and you did talk about how Darwin's moment in history was, British history, was such that there was this sort of new wave of British imperialism, particularly on the continent of Africa and other what we call third world countries today. And Darwin saw some of this firsthand in his voyages around the world. I particularly remember, Richard, he had a personal friendship with one of the natives that had been taken to England earlier, and then they took him back to the tip of South America. And they later came back again a second time, and Darwin was appalled at how this man had actually become sort of reacclimated to his own indigenous culture, wasn't wearing European clothing, and Darwin thought this was a backward step for him. Now, this is, of course, a very Eurocentric view of people, but it is indicative of the kind of views that Darwin had. So what impact, then, did Darwinian racism have on scientists in the late 19th and early 20th centuries?
Well, that's a great question, because a lot of people, when they talk about Darwin's racism, they'll sort of make it tangential to his theory and see that, and sort of play it down to some degree. Now, I should mention, though, that there are some scholars, Adrian Desmond and James Moore, who've written a biography of Darwin that do make actually pretty clear his racism and how it was integrated into his theory. So I'm not the only person, saying some of these things.
Yeah, and that's a leading biography. So it's,
yes, it is.
Mention it. Yeah.
And not only that, but they published another book about Darwin's views about slavery, where they very interestingly claim that they think that Darwin's anti-slavery views were integral in his views about human evolution. And a lot of people have latched onto that and said, see, Darwin, but then they don't read the entire book, because Desmond and Moore, even in that book, make clear that still Darwin embraced ideas of racial extermination and such. And so even though he was anti-slavery, he wasn't anti-slavery because he thought the races were equal. He thought that if you got rid of slavery, then the blacks would not have the protection that they had. He thought that slavery actually protected the blacks from being decimated all the more, and that in open competition, they would ultimately die out and the Europeans would triumph. So it's a very interesting point of view. But interestingly, if you look at, as I'd already mentioned before in the earlier podcast, Darwin was taking ideas that already existed about racism and about racial inferiority and such, and he integrated them into his theory. But by integrating him into his theory, people coming after Darwin actually used Darwin's ideas to justify further racism. So Stephen Jay Gould, who himself is a Darwinist, he's also a historian of science, he admitted that racism in the late 19th century increased by orders of magnitude after Darwin came on the scene. And part of that was because of Darwin's theory justifying racism, and because biological determinism saw a very big upswing right at the end of the 19th and on into the early 20th centuries. And so racism actually became more intense after the scientists began pushing it, and Darwin was a part of that.
That makes sense, doesn't it? Since science has such cultural authority, especially since the 19th century and the technological applications of science, it seemed like science was making our lives better. So why not, take control of this and make it even better through controlling human heredity?
Sure, exactly. And you're right. I mean, if you want people to believe something that you're saying, tell them it's science, you know. You know,
yeah.
And suddenly, I guess it must be true, you know. In the late 19th and early 20th centuries, racism was mainstream among anthropologists, among biologists, in medical faculties. Racism was mainstream. It was not some quirky idea or something. It was considered scientific. And just to give an example of how this played itself out, Darwin himself, in The Descent of Man, looked at the cranial capacities of different races on the earth. And guess what? The Black Africans have smaller cranial capacities on the average than the Europeans do. And so this was used as so-called scientific evidence that Europeans were more intelligent.
Right. And never mind that cranial capacity doesn't correlate with intelligence. But anyway, right. It's part of their story.
Right. They assumed it did. Of course, that's the problem with science. I mean, science is a wonderful thing and science can teach us many, many, many things. And I'm not denigrating science in the slightest.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
But if you make a wrong assumption, all your conclusions are going to end up being wrong. And so in this case, they made the assumption that cranial capacity correlated to intelligence. Of course, it doesn't. By the way, Darwin also used that to claim that males were more intelligent than females because their cranial capacity was bigger than females.
Right. Yeah, and we're talking about cranial capacity within the human population. There's quite a huge variance. Now, of course, if you take a totally different creature, you know, like a cockroach, obviously the nervous system is not even the sort that could contain a being that has self-consciousness and free will and all that. But still, we're talking about within the human family,
right.
There's quite a bit of variation.
Sure. And of course, this was just reinforcing prejudices that had been built up over centuries relating to these people. So to them, they sort of didn't even question that Black Africans were intellectually inferior. That was a commonplace at the time.
So you earlier mentioned Francis Galton as a founder of eugenics, the attempt to breed humans to be better. And Galton's views on heredity and their application in scientific technology to supposedly make a better humanity, how are those ideas connected specifically with Darwin's theory, his cousin's theory?
Well, Galton came upon the ideas of trying to build better human heredity by reading Darwin's Origin of Species. That's by his own confession. Galton said that he was reading Darwin's Origin of Species, and this gave him the idea of trying to breed better humans. And of course, if you believe in the theory of evolution, then you believe that biological change is constantly going on anyway. And so you're keyed into the idea that, oh yeah, we can, you know, make things better, improve the human species even beyond what they are. Also, the other key element too of Darwinian theory that was going to be built into all of this, and is especially important in relation to racism, is the fact that Darwin claimed that humans were reproducing faster than their food supply, that he got from Thomas Malthus, and that because of that, they were in an inescapable struggle for existence. And this is a competition to the death. I mean, it doesn't have to necessarily be carried out by war, but it's still going to be a competition where some are going to die out and some are going to survive. And so he thought that these certain superior races were going to outcompete the Black Africans, for example, or the Australian Aborigines and such because of their superior intelligence and such, and that they were then going to take over. So Galton was going to, by trying to breed better humans, he promoted the idea of biological determinism, the idea that behavior and intelligence and such is all determined biologically. And this was going to then have pretty significant impacts on racism. A lot of the people following after Galton in the eugenics movement were intensely racist as well, although some people focused more on trying to improve the human heredity within their own countries, within their own race. There were differences of emphasis there, but still most of them did think that the Europeans were ultimately superior, just like most anthropologists did at the time.
Right. So what else can you tell us about the interplay between eugenics and racism in the 19th and early 20th centuries? They seem like they fed off each other to some extent.
Well, yeah, I think they did, because for one thing, both of them were embracing biological determinism. So in that sense, they share that kind of idea. Now, you could be a eugenicist without being a racist. That's theoretically possible, but there were very few eugenicists who were not racists at the time. And so because they both believe in biological determinism, and because the eugenicists were trying to improve human heredity, if you think that certain races are inferior, part of improving human heredity then is to get rid of those inferior races. Right. And by the way, this is how then it feeds into Hitler's ideology as well, because Hitler was going to embrace eugenics and racism. And Hitler believed that by getting rid of inferior races, he was improving the human species. Now, obviously, most eugenicists didn't go to the extent Hitler did, but many of them did support things like compulsory sterilization. And the compulsory sterilization was exercised not only against people who were had mental illnesses, but sometimes there were racially based people of colored race tended to be more targets of the eugenicists very often as well. And so there were some, and Margaret Sanger, whom we mentioned before, who was a key person in the birth control movement and such, was very intensely racist. And she tried to promote birth control as a way of improving the human species. And specifically because she was trying to get what she saw as the lower races to get on birth control so they wouldn't have as many children.
Yeah, that's appalling. So this scientific racism that we're talking about, it, which is, of course, the scientific component of it is highly questionable. And that's one of the missions of Discovery Institute and its Center for Science and Culture is to look at alternatives to the bad science that results in, historically, in many cases, racism. Now, of course, we critique it on its own scientific merits. That's the primary thing. But it's also interesting to track what the ideas were and what consequences they had. And that's what you and I do as historians of science. So why did this scientific, so-called scientific form of racism decline in the 20th century? What happened?
Yeah, well, in the middle of the 20th century, there was a pretty significant decline. Part of it was because France Boas, an anthropologist at Columbia University, was led into an anthropological school that emphasized cultural determinism or environmental determinism rather than biological determinism. And so this was militating against biological racism. And he was going to have a pretty profound impact. Also, Ashley Montague in Britain, another prominent anthropologist, likewise in the middle of the 20th century, was beginning to promote a more anti-racist anthropology. So in the field of anthropology, there was a move away from racism already and also move away from biological determinism already in the 1920s, 1930s, and then after that time. Of course, there was a backlash against the Nazis as well because of the things they had done with their eugenics program, their sterilization program, their euthanasia program, killing people with disabilities. So there's something of a backlash against that also in the post-World War II period. There also was, of course, a rise of the New Left. There was a rise of Marxism and such, which promotes environmental determinism rather than biological determinism. So there were quite a number of things that were working together in the middle of the 20th century to damp down racism. The civil rights movement also, of course, was going to arise, and more blacks were getting education. It was becoming clearer that they were not intellectually inferior. So we're acquiring more data. So thankfully, over the course of the middle of the 20th century, scientific racism was going to die down pretty considerably to where the mainstream scientists by the 1960s and 70s were typically anti-racist. There were some exceptions. James Watson, who was the co-discoverer of the double helix model of the DNA and won a Nobel Prize for that, continued to embrace scientific racism, although he tried to keep his mouth shut, although occasionally he it divulged it. Yeah. His racist views, but he continued to embrace racism. And also there's on the fringes of society today, of course, we have white nationalists and neo-Nazis who are embracing some of the same kinds of scientific racism that were very prominent in the 1890s and early 1900s.
So scientific racism is still with us, and you've mentioned the alt-right
yes.
kind of folks. What other sort of summary comments can you make as we wrap up today's conversation about how scientific racism is still with us today, at least in some forms?
Yeah. Well, yeah, thankfully it's marginalized. It's not, you know, it's not mainstream. Mainstream scientists don't embrace these ideas. Although biological determinism, by the way, has become more in vogue in the late 20th century with E.O. Wilson's Sociobiology and Evolutionary Psychology, which the alt-right does latch onto and try to use to leverage their scientific racism. Most scientists don't, however, thankfully. Mm-hmm. But yeah, the alt-right is promoting, if you look at the alt, I've been working on a book on Darwinian racism. And so I've looked at a lot of alt-right and white nationalist websites and such, and they're promoting exactly the same ideas. Maybe that shouldn't be surprising. They're neo-Nazis, so they're promoting exactly the same ideas that the Nazis were promoting with their racism, claiming that it's scientific, and they promote Darwinism very heavily. Darwinian theory plays a very big part of alt-right and white nationalist promotion of racism because they believe that certain people groups and races have evolved to different levels. And so some are more intelligent than others, and they believe the white Europeans are more intelligent than the black Africans. So they use that as a way to promote their forms of white nationalism. And they see the races as being in inevitable competition. So there you have the natural struggle, the struggle for existence that they think is going to bring about natural selection. So they're promoting many of the same ideas that the scientific racists of the early 20th century were promoting.
Well, we're going to come back to that topic when your new book comes out. So I'm going to stop you right there because there's lots of great stuff. I've read your book, as you know, and loved it, this new book. But the books that our listeners can consult now include The Death of Humanity and The Case for Life, 2016, and several books about Hitler, Hitler's ethic, Hitler's religion, and then, of course, the original book based on your dissertation, From Darwin to Hitler, with a major publisher that you've used a lot, actually, Palgrave Macmillan, and they've done well for you. They got great covers, by the way, Richard. I always like their covers.
Thanks.
But the content is spectacular, and thanks for relating some of this, connecting it with contemporary issues about racism and monuments and that sort of thing. So thanks for joining us today, Richard.
Yeah, it's great talking to you, Mike.
So this is Mike Keyes with ID the Future, and thank you for joining us today.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org and idthefuture.com.